You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Tolinsky and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax. We got a potluck for you today. Lots of interesting questions around JavaScript, React, CSS. Somebody has a decent idea of how to use generators. We've talked a lot about that. Some addendums to the layers episode and all kinds of great stuff. Looking forward to talking about it. My name is Wes Boss. I'm a developer from Canada. With me, as always, Mr. Scott Tolinsky. How are you doing today, Scott?
Doing good, my man. Just hanging out. Not too much to report. Just feeling the holiday vibe. We took a train in the mountains to see Santa with the kids. And it was an old silver mining train. And you take this train through this really just picturesque scene, and Santa's on board and everything like that. And it was just, it really got you into the holiday vibe. The kids were going nuts for it. They had a great time. So yeah, just feeling it. Yeah.
Well, this episode goes live December 27th. So Merry Christmas to everybody. Hopefully you enjoyed your time.
And happy holidays.
And happy holidays.
Syntax is presented by Sentry. If you're shipping software and users are using it, you want to make sure that you have a handle on your bugs before your users hit them. Not only does Sentry give you access to finding and fixing all of those bugs, but they also give you incredibly useful tools like session replay, test coverage, performance metrics, and tons more. So head on over to sentry.io, use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you'll get 2 months for free.
Let's get into the first question here from Gordon Liu. How much of programming, I laughed at this question, so I put it first. How much of programming is general advanced technical stuff versus fancy complex sounding names for things?
Yeah, seriously.
Feels like all the time I'll learn about something new called predicate inference pattern on composition member inheritance proxies. When it's just some plain old function thing I've written 10 million times. And I can't agree more. I read this and I was like, there's so many things in JavaScript, and I have a bunch of names. I have a bunch of examples here that we'll rattle through.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad you wrote this, because that's the first one that came to mind was singleton. Okay.
Yes. And every time I'm like, oh, what's that advanced concept?
Oh, anything? My God.
And then you get into it, you go, oh, that's just a different way to use a function, or that's just a different way to store variables. So let's go through a couple of them here. First one is tuples. A tuple is a very scary sounding name for an array where the length and the item types are known. So if you have an array of an ID and a person, and the first item is the ID and the second item is a person, that's a tuple.
It's a tuple. Next one is singleton. Again, this is one of those ones. Why do we have to have a crazy name for this? So singleton, a value that is only created once and reused. Okay, constant.
Very, very simple. Factory, a function for dynamically creating objects or classes.
Dependency injection. This one always gets me too. Passing in the things that a function needs to run. Yes, it's dependency injection.
The dependency part I get. The injection sounds a little fancy, you know?
It sounds too fancy to me.
Mixins, combined and reused code from multiple sources. I tried to like summarize these in like 5 or 6 words. And obviously there's a bit more to all of these, but at the end of the day, they are simple things.
Simple things. Memoization. You remember the results. The next time you do not have to recompute it. You're caching the result, essentially.
A high order function or higher order function is a function that returns a function.
Yep. Yep. That's it. Man, it doesn't have to be this hard. These things can be described in such easy ways. But again, sometimes the language used is scarier than the concept itself. And I think that is, you know, you got to name things. So things have to have names, but couldn't we give them simple names or friendlier names? Who knows? There's probably a long history for a reason why that is. Also, this question was asked by Gordon Liu, who I got to say, I don't know if this is your real name or not, because this is the name of a very famous kung fu actor. And I'm wondering if the OP tip of this question knew this. This is the actor from such fine films as the 36th Chamber of Shaolin, you know, a very famous kung fu film there. So
next one we have here from Travis Hubbard. This is an interesting one. A little advance. I spent like 20 minutes before the episode trying to understand it, and I get it. And this is, dudes, I've done it. I found a non-trivial use case for generators. So a little bit of backstory. We talk a lot on this podcast that, like, we've have a couple good examples for generators, but like in practice, I've never actually implemented a generator in my code base. So this was, Travis has stumbled upon something in his code base, and I thought it was really interesting. So I'm going to read through it and then sort of sprinkle in some explanations as we go. So imagine you're creating a Jira or Trello board experience with multiple columns, and each column has an array of cards in it. So to do, progress, whatever, you get it, right? You have three columns. Each column will have three cards each. I have one service called a card data service that holds the data from the server for each card. So example, a card would have an ID, title, description, etc. I have a separate service that takes in a single record of card data and interpolates that into various HTML JSX components to build out the visual card for the display view, right? So it takes in data, returns some templating out. So if all of this were a single service, you'd have a ton of nested loops, right? I need a loop to loop over every column, then a loop for every card data element in that column, and then a loop for React to actually render it on out. And then I've bolded this part right here. It gets wacky to reason inside of nested loops like that, because anywhere you need to access the full card data again, you're duplicating loops. I thought this was interesting. If you want to be able to, like, you get data from the server and it returns an array of three columns, and each of those columns you have arrays of cards. Anytime you need access to all of those cards, maybe you want to display a list of them, or maybe you just want to find a specific card in that, you find yourself writing multiple loops to sort of get access to them all. So this is what Travis says. In my card data service, the card that holds the data, I have a generator function. So this is a function called cards data. And inside of that, it has nested loops. The first one loops over the columns. The second one loops over the cards inside of that column, right? And the important part here is that finally, inside of that nested loop, you yield the data for that specific card. Now, this generator function is now just a function that contains all the complexity of looping over those nested values and returns to you, or sorry, doesn't return, it yields each piece of card data. And the important part about yielding there is that you can then use a generator function in anything that accepts an iterable. So a for loop is probably the most common. Now, he simply just has to use a single for loop to be able to iterate over every single card without having to go through it. So I thought this was pretty interesting. And I sort of summarized it here. A complex loop can be made flatter or simpler. Anytime you need to access all of the cards, this generator function will give you a nice simple loop without having to worry about the complexity of the way the data is formatted. So immediately I was like, well, why not just use array.flat, right? Like, why not reduce it down into a single value? And I think probably in most cases I would still reach for a flat, but it might not be as simple as that, because flat assumes that it's not a synchronous operation, right? What if in every single iteration of that, you need to do some sort of async await, you need to pull an API for that specific item. There's a lot that could possibly happen there, right? So, or there might be cards that are added to the end of the array as you are parsing earlier cards. So there might be some sort of logic that says, all right, well, if this card has something in it, we need to add something to the end of it. So a generator is helpful in that case, because a generator doesn't know when it will be done. It will simply keep going until you no longer yield any data. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I haven't run into that specifically myself, but I think that's like the first like solid use case of a generator function that we've heard here.
It's still a bit of a mystery, to be honest, Wes. I know that was a really good explanation, and I get it. But like in the same regard, I just don't hit that situation. But interesting, man. It makes me want to explore them more. You know, makes me want to do just more research.
Yeah, I think the important part here is like know what it is, and at some point, like Travis here, you're going to hit something where you go, "Damn, sure. This is a pain in the ass to do this double loop inside of it," and I have this weird little.
Mm-hmm.
The way that we do it is a little bit weird, you know, and a generator would be a good use case there. If you have a use case for a generator that you're using, please send it to us, tweet us, SyntaxFM, send me an email. I'd love to hear it.
We would love to generate some content from that. Next one is from Fodiman. Fodiman says, in episode 698, you talked about CSS at layers. For some sites that statically link in styles for dependencies that aren't using layers, those styles would be applied atop of your layered styles. This could be one reason why no one is really using layers yet. For example, imagine including styles for Bootstrap. You want to overwrite those styles to match your theme. With layers, you'd probably need to be an all or nothing approach. Else, those external dependencies are almost treated like import rules, overriding your styles and layers. What are some solutions to this problem? Yes, the solutions to this problem is one, just bring that CSS in-house, wrap it in a layer. That's what I do. I pretty much, if I'm using a third-party CSS solution, I'm putting it into my layers earlier in, I forget which type of layer you would put that in. It could be a like part of your base layer, but maybe the next one out. It could be that your third party layer, or your system, or your layout layer, depending on what that is. And I'm gonna copy and paste it, or I'm going to use the import with the layer in the import. Either way, my most general solution to that is to copy and paste that CSS into my CSS and wrap it in a layer. In fact, we did do that on the Syntax website for CSS that is coming in from a third party. For instance, the Media Chrome CSS that came in for our video player, we wanted to override that with our own properties, our own theming stuff. We put that into a layer in that way. So yes, this is also a good reason, you know, why this exists is because, you know, we don't want CSS that's not in a layer to get overwritten by CSS that is in a layer, because I think that scenario would be way more confusing than do all your layers first and then you apply everything else on top of it. But again, my solution is to bring that in-house anyways. And I would do that even if I wasn't using layers, just because I don't typically like to link to third-party CSS hosted elsewhere.
Yeah, that whole like CDN linking external CSS, I still have some sites that do it, but I haven't done it in, I don't know, probably 4 years or so. You know, like if you're using Bootstrap, probably better to NPM install it and include it in your bundle. The benefit to linking it off of a CDN is and was that if another website, same with jQuery, if another website had already loaded that, then your user doesn't need to re-download it, right? Like you go to Scott.com, he loaded jQuery and Bootstrap. Go to West.com. Oh, I need the same version of jQuery and Bootstrap. Oh, it's already in my browser's cache. Doesn't need to re-download it. But it's, in most cases, you just import it. There also is, you talked about, you can use at import URL. You could import the CSS in your CSS with the at import rule. The downside to that is you have a waterfall request. Yep. So you can fix that with a link rel DNS prefetch in your head, and that will tell the browser, hey, I'm going to need this at some point. Go fetching this thing ahead of time. And then you can give it a layer after that, like you said. But there also is a proposal. Looks like Miriam, Suzanne, and Brahmas, past show guests, a couple other people are sort of going through the standards process right now to add a layer attribute to a link tag.
Ooh, yeah.
And this would allow you to say, all right, link in Bootstrap, but throw all of the resulting CSS into the layer of Bootstrap.
And that solves that problem right there. So yeah, let's hope we get that.
So hopefully, I'm actually surprised that that didn't make its way into the initial spec. Because that's a pretty common use case, you know?
Yeah, maybe it's just one of those things that, you know, sometimes things slip through the cracks, or maybe they thought about it and couldn't get it in. So it
wasn't important at first. Yeah. Next question from Nils. Some episodes ago, you guys mentioned something with a database prefix that allows you to use the same database for multiple projects. Can you tell me what that was? Because I cannot find the episode and Googling is not helping me. Love the podcast. So first, I cannot wait to get the AI embeddings going, because like that would be such a simple thing to say, when did one of them talk about database prefixes, and it would find the actual part where they had talked about it. But I don't know. Scott, do you remember what this is? If not, I have some notes on other possible ways.
No. And I honestly have no idea what this person is talking about. So
I think what you are referring to is the idea when you create tables with your ORM, you often have the ability to pass it a prefix. So the most common example of this is WordPress. If you have one MySQL database and you can only put one WP_posts table in there, right? And if you have two WordPress installs, you point them to the same database, they're going to both use the same tables. But if you want them to be separate, but in the same database for whatever reason, you can change the WP_prefix in your WP config file and set that to literally anything you want. A lot of people do that just for security reasons. If your database was ever exposed, a lot of the robots would just automatically check for the WP_whatever tables. But that's not really, that's a bit of a security by obscurity thing. So you could just prefix all of your tables with a specific prefix when you build it. That makes me a little bit nervous though, putting multiple projects in a single database.
Yeah.
I think like if you're trying to like sidestep paying for databases, I could maybe understand that, but maybe if that's the case, learn how to host your own MySQL instance. Because if you have one MySQL instance, you can have multiple databases in there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a, it's an interesting thing. It's not something that I ever do personally.
I would just be scared that you would accidentally like delete something and like you would have like one project that like you press like, oh, like restart this project, and it would just wipe the entire database.
Yeah. Yeah. I typically tend to do a one, try to compartmentalize that stuff as much as possible. Next question is from Mila. Is it better to be a generalist or a specialist as a front-end dev? Now, I think this answer can go two ways. It's better to be a generalist if you would like to do more. I want to be able to build a site that does this and this and this and has a backend and has this all by myself. I want to work on this thing and I just want to create. Right? Being a generalist gives you a lot of freedom in that you have the abilities, whether or not you are in depth with those abilities, but you have the abilities to do a lot of different things. And therefore, you can create more without having to spend a lot of time looking up other things or instituting other people in there to help you. If you're a specialist, you obviously can go deeper on a specific topic. You can become an expert. And oftentimes, if that expertise is needed, you can get paid more for being a specialist, right? As long as that specialty is maybe a rarer skill or perhaps a skill that's in demand, right? You have the whole supply and demand of skills here. If you are a specialist of a skill that is in demand, you can bring in a lot more money than if you're a generalist. But if you're a generalist, you can do anything you want. You have total freedom, but you might not be able to command anything that is, you know, a very specific nature. Now, again, it depends on what your goals are. If your goal is to get hired by a company and that company is looking for a specialist and you are a generalist, they will toss your application out. I'm a good JavaScript developer. I'm gonna toot my own horn there, right? I can do a lot with JavaScript. And if you put an Angular 1 project in front of me and said, hey, get this to this point, I can get it to that point and I can do it very well. But if I were to apply for an Angular 1 job and they were to say, explain this aspect of Angular 1, I would say, hey, I can't. I can't do that off the dome. I just straight up can't. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I might get overlooked for that opportunity. In fact, I would. And that has happened to me. So you have to understand, like, what is it that you're after in this industry and go for that based on what you need there. I like being a generalist more because I'm a tinkerer. I like to get my hands dirty with a lot of stuff and make fun things for myself. And Wes, I know you're very much the same way, right?
Yeah. I think that, like, people always ask me, like, are you a generalist or a specialist? And I don't really know the answer to that. Like, I'm a generalist web developer, meaning that, like, anything that encompasses web development, so Node backend, literally any of the other JavaScript backends, React, Svelte, Vanilla, CSS, all the parts of JavaScript from audio synthesis, webcam, all the way over to working with the DOM and crypto, you know, like not Bitcoin. Every time we say crypto, I have to say like, not Bitcoin, no, crypto,
the cryptography. Crypto package.
Yeah. Yes. So like I'm generalist in that, like Scott said, you could put most of the stuff in front of me and I would be able to figure it out. And that is a very good thing to have on your resume because you're a bit of like a bingo player. You know, you go through a resume. Oh, this person has worked with X, Y, and Z. I specialize in web development. You know, I don't know Python. I don't know Go, Rust, or any of these other languages. I could probably figure a few things out here or there, but if I saw a resume where somebody rattled off PHP, Python, Go, Rust, JavaScript, you know, I would look at that and say, yeah, right. You know, like there's no chance that you're really good at all of those things.
Yeah. And it depends on how much you zoom out, right? Because you could almost say the same thing about somebody who says, I'm good at Angular, React, whatever, Svelte, because you could be good at all of those things. But there are people who know the React code base inside and out, right? They know the actual, all of the nuance there, or you could just be effective with it. And I think it's important to state that being a generalist doesn't mean that you are not skilled or less skilled. It just means that your area of expertise is wider rather than narrower. So, you know, some people see a specialist and a generalist as like somebody who knows a little bit about a lot versus a lot of bit about a little. And sure, it can be that way. But, you know, sometimes generalists know a lot of bit about a lot too.
Next question from Josh Collinsworth. Hey guys, just noticed I can't find the sick pics page on the new site. Any plans to bring that back? I found it super handy for myself, so I didn't have to dig through hundreds of episodes wondering when did they talk about that thing, especially nice to have around the Christmas season. I have an open issue on GitHub for this. So I forget who it was. Somebody wrote the sick pics page from the old website and they literally just wrote a regex that was resilient enough to figure out what is the data below the sick pics H2. And it says sick or pics. And then stop before you hit the next H2. They just parsed them on out. So the show notes haven't changed. So theoretically, we could go back and grab that code to parse the show notes. I have an open issue. If anybody wants to work on it or re-implement that, it would be really cool. But I would love to get that page back up and running.
Yeah. Yeah, agreed. We got to get that going. Next one from CL. I'm a woman full stack engineer working at a major video game company, and I'm very proud of what I've achieved in my career. However, I work extra hard because not only It's not easy for us women to succeed in a man-dominant field like software development. I've also been struggling with anxiety, depression, and ADHD. Can you guys give some advice on how to grow and improve as developers struggling with ADHD? Are there some specific learning techniques you can recommend? Thank you so much. I love the show. I hope you can bring more women on in the future. Yes, we are. A lot of plans there. You know, one thing here I think that's important is go back and listen to, we did an episode with my wife, Dr. Courtney Tolinsky on ADHD. She gives a lot of really good advice. That's episode number 532. She gives a lot of great advice on managing your ADHD and understanding it. I think there's definitely a lot here, especially developer-wise, and understanding like what works for you and what doesn't work for you. Because honestly, I get presented some documentation pages where my eyes just glaze over. But you know what I can do is I can select all that text, I can have it read it to me, and it can pipe it into my ear. And for some reason, I just handle that better. I get less distracted, right? And that distractibility, paying attention and like really understanding what pulls you away, what doesn't pull you away, what pulls you in, what engages you, can really be a big factor in growing with these skills. I'm even struggling lately, Wes, with compile times and stuff. I've been doing a lot of compiled languages, working in some game development stuff, been working in some Rust stuff. I'll compile it, and then I'll tab over to something else, even though that compile step takes a second. I'll compile it and then get distracted in that compile time. It's absurd. So, you know, I've been struggling this with myself. I think one of the biggest things you can possibly do is to schedule, and keep yourself on that schedule. I make a firm to-do list. Whenever I'm feeling scattered, I make that to-do list. I put it on my schedule. I make the things that are, here's the highest priority, here's the lowest priority, and I start with that highest priority, and I just keep grinding at it until I knock it out. Those are some of the biggest things for me. But also, again, like understanding how you consume your educational material. Like I said, I do better with video and audio. I can put on a video, listen to that, and understand more than I can via reading a blog post. And if I can get that blog post in audio, I can get that even better for me. So, it's work. I'll tell you that. It's work. So, check out that episode. There's a lot of great techniques and tips inside of there.
Yeah. For me, it's about a couple things. First, like the to-do list is massive for me in terms of like, what do I do next? But specifically, you're asking about like learning techniques here. For me, it's 100% about doing something that I am interested in. If I'm bored or not interested in, I'm not going to learn anything. Yeah. But if I'm like super excited about, like I built the this thing the other day and I wanted to learn how to use the AI GPT Vision and this like voice synthesis APIs. So I built like this thing where Tim Cook announces me and Ricky from Trailer Park Boys takes a photo of me and roasts how I look. And like I was glued for probably like 5 hours straight on that. And I learned so much about how that works. Why? Because that's super fun. And I just sort of followed my energy with that type of thing. Whereas if I were sitting there following the tutorials on the website, I wouldn't be as stoked on that type of thing. So you really got to try stuff and figure out what you enjoy. And you're going to eventually find some systems that work for you.
Yeah, I do love that. Letting your excitement drive you. Like I mentioned, I've been doing some fun game development, been trying out Godot and learning this scripting language there, which is very Python-esque, right, Wes? You can pick it up pretty easily. And you know what? I did the tutorial, and yes, I noticed that as my attention was starting to drift in that tutorial, I pulled it back to the code itself and said, all right, I now have made enough where I can get this sprite on the screen rotating and moving. That's enough where maybe I should take a break from the tutorial and just see what else I can make it do. I know code. I know I now understand how to make thing move when I press key, what other things can I do? Can I make it go forwards, backwards, rotate? Can I have it drive around the screen? Next thing you know, I got a little sprite car driving around the screen. Why? Well, I was getting that point where I was feeling like I can feel my attention drifting, and it's nice to be able to recognize that. But oftentimes you don't even recognize it. It's just gone, right?
Next question from Jesse Pence. Any chance you could make an embeddable player? I'm a blog author and would love to be able to put something right in the middle of an article. Bonus points if you could add a query param that lets me link to a specific time. Yes, this is on our list of things we would love to do, because like if people are a guest on the show and they want to embed it into their website, if you have a blog post, you want to be able to embed it like even further. It would be really cool to be able to like clip something, like have, like you said, add a query param for linking to a specific time, but also pulling the transcript in and maybe visualizing that at somehow. There's so many ideas we have around that, and an embeddable player is the front. I was looking into the like, what's the, there's like an open embed spec.
Oh yeah.
A lot of places support open embeds, and all you have to do is like submit your website to a specific, who is it? It was the TL-DRAW. TL-DRAW supports embeds, and they use some service that approves and denies embeds. And then things like WordPress, you can just do a short code and it will embed it right away. So I think that...
Or Discord or Slack.
Yeah. Yeah. Discord, Slack.
I think about like, yeah, Spotify has that kind of stuff. Yes, this will be coming. And, you know, since this episode is coming out December 27th, you know, I think there is a good chance that this thing could be well on its way, if not done by then. But yes, it's definitely in the pipeline here. We're working on it. Next one here from Nick. This is a supper club suggestion. The people behind Cards Against Humanity always do interesting Black Friday promos. This year, it was a pseudo social network called Yowza. In years past, they've auctioned off ridiculous items. All these have necessitated a website or app. I'd love to hear from their team and working for such a unique company. Yeah, I would love to do that as well. How do you feel about that, Wes? We got to, if any of those devs are out there listening to this, hit us up. We would love to have you on the show. I think these kind of things are really super neat in terms of like, these are the types of projects that as a developer, I think you should get excited for, because they are unique one-off opportunities. You can really flex some of your skills without having to be like, is this thing a long-lasting web service that a billion people are going to use? Or is this a fun experiment that's going to get attention? In fact, I was just looking at, Stripe Press just released a really cool site called the Poor Charles Almanac. And I'll share this with you, Wes. And again, it's the type of site that is like a one-off kind of, you do it, you flex some skills, and you show off a little bit. And I do love that. So Cards Against Humanity, folks, yeah, let's get you on the show if we can.
Who knows? I always find this stuff super interesting as well, where it looks like the Yowza social network is just a Mastodon instance that they spun up, which is pretty nifty. I also went into the auction stuff is really interesting to me, because even when I was selling t-shirts, I had like a limited number of t-shirts. And if two people buy the shirt at the same time, then you ended up with negative inventory, because like if two people add it to the cart, a lot of times, as soon as it's in a cart, they'll take that inventory off the shelf so that somebody else can't. But a lot of other places, my cart included, was just, all right, we'll throw it in your cart. And then when you check out, then you pay for it. So what happens if both people pay for it at the same second? You know, there can be issues there. I'm always curious about that with like online bidding and auctions and things like that. It's a tricky thing. So I'd love to talk to somebody. If anyone knows anyone at Cards Against Humanity, I went deep. I was like, what are they using for this thing? And it looks like they built their entire own fulfillment company called Black Box, blackbox.cool. And they do their own fulfillment for all their stuff. And they just basically built an entire fulfillment company to do the Cards Against Humanity. And I'm sure they have a really nifty web team behind all of this stuff.
Word.
Next question from Thomas Eckert. Thank you both for putting on such a fantastic show. I am a developer working in the United States, and next year I will be moving to Ottawa for personal reasons. I have my permanent residency, so the job field there is open for me. While I have a job I can continue doing from Canada, as I continue my career, I will be doing so in the wilderness of the Canadian job market. What are some of the differences between being a professional developer in Canada versus the United States? Is it easier to become an indie dev in Canada with universal healthcare and the social safety net? What might I find surprising about being a dev in Canada? What you will find surprising about being a dev in Canada is it doesn't pay as well as the jobs in the States. We have a real problem. It's called brain drain. And a lot of our talent, Ben Vinegar, manager of Syntax, he went down to San Francisco for I don't know how many years. He's back now. He lives in Canada, but he went down there. A lot of new grads out of some of our big tech schools go directly down to Silicon Valley or whatnot and work in jobs there. So they certainly don't pay as well. However, you're moving to Ottawa, and you know what's in Ottawa? Shopify.
They are?
A big problem. I've talked to a lot of people in Ottawa. It's a big problem trying to hire good devs in Ottawa because Shopify snatches them all up. It might be maybe a little different now that they're a little bit more remote, but that certainly was an issue before the pandemic.
I thought you were going to say the Ottawa Senators.
Oh, they're there too. Yeah. It's very cold in Ottawa, so buckle up. What else about Canada? Canada's very expensive. Housing is silly. Housing is out of control in a lot of places in the world right now. But Canada is...
It's certainly out of control in Denver.
Yeah. About Canada is there's not really anywhere you can go right now. In the States, it's always interesting seeing how people move to Denver or move to Portland or move to Austin. And in Canada, we don't necessarily have anywhere good to go. It's pretty much you live in BC, you live in Southern Ontario, and then of course there's lots of other places, but flights inside of Canada are silly expensive. So you don't see a lot of people move away from where their families are because it's prohibitively expensive to go fly and see your family a couple times a year, like a ticket for us to visit Saskatchewan. My wife's family used to live there would be like $800-$900. For a return ticket, and you got five people in your family, that gets a little bit too expensive. So telecom, really expensive. I was just praising telecom the other day. My cell phone bill went from $99 a month Canadian to $45 a month. And I went from 50 gigs to 55 gigs. And I was like, this is amazing. And then I got all these people being like, in India, you get 1,000 gigs for $6. And then people are like, in Europe, we get unlimited for 19 euro. And it's just not the same. I realize Canada is a big country, but it seems like our telecom and groceries are ruled by a couple evil beings.
Yeah.
I have some more points here, but what's it like living in the States as a developer?
You don't say A as much. I don't know. I've always lived in the States. So
yeah.
Initially from Michigan and now in Colorado. I got to say, Michigan was definitely more Canadian than Colorado is. Colorado is way more like cowboy country. Yeah, I don't know. It's not too hard for us to go back to Detroit area to visit family. Not hard at all. You know, hop on a plane or driving is no fun. So long drives or whatever like that is probably not super good. But you know what? I don't know. I've always worked remote from wherever I am in the States and haven't had to do much of anything else in the tech scene. So
talking about being an indie dev, that's the probably the biggest benefit here is so our doctors are covered by the government or by our taxes. So it's hard to find a doctor, very hard to find a family doctor here, but if you can find one or you can go to a walk-in clinic, they will pay for that. Medications are not covered. I always think back to the Simpsons episode where Homer went to Canada and there's just pills dropping from the sky. And I always think like, that's not true. You still have to pay for your medications. You just, if you're under 25, the government will cover it if you don't have insurance, but over, you got to pay for it yourself. But that said, I'm self-employed and a large reason why I am self-employed and a large reason why I've been able to do what I can do is because health insurance, including dental medications, all that stuff, so much cheaper. I've heard like stories in the States where people pay thousands of dollars a month just for their own insurance, where in Canada, it's hundreds of dollars a month.
Yeah. And in that regard, I've always, you know, I've always leaned on my wife to have her insurance when I was working for myself, simply because I did not want to deal with that. I just didn't want to deal with it. Even as a, even as an S corporation owner, my company wasn't big enough to really get any good healthcare options. And I was doing it through Gusto even. So yeah, always leaned on my partner for that. It stinks that your healthcare is tied to your job. That doesn't make a ton of sense to me. Next question here from Trevor Goodchild. Trevor is the good child. Is HTML over the wire awesome or super awesome? Wes, do you want to talk a little bit about HTML over the wire?
Yeah. So this is in response to a lot of the JavaScript frameworks going server rendered. And what is now happening is as somebody who is a avid scraper and dev tools inspector, I've been noticing this quite a lot lately, is a lot of websites are going away from the whole JSON API and simply just returning JavaScript. It's funny because that was the way a long time ago, and a lot of these websites still return jQuery. But now we're starting to see, oh, you want to refresh that component? Let's just render it on the server and send the result in HTML over the wire. So is it awesome? Yeah, because you don't have to do the whole like fetch request and data in the client. That can be a benefit. It can be a downside in some cases, but can be a major benefit. As a scraper, I'm a bit sad because it means that if you want to pull data from a specific service, you're often met with HTML that you now need to parse out rather than just a nice clean JSON feed.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in this space. You know, HTMX being one that has been very vocal online, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So, hey, I think it's something that we're just going to hear more and more about. It's kind of annoying that some folks are turning this into like a culture war type of thing, but I do think it's like a very valid and interesting area to explore regardless.
Last question from Mike. Hey guys, working with Next.js 13, using Prisma and Vercel for hosting, I'm developing locally and would like to use a development local Postgres database. I've been searching for a while and can't seem to find out how to make that happen. Ideally, I run a dev command, npm run dev, and load in a development.env file, sort of like .env.development with local creds for a Postgres database. Then once I'm ready to build, I run the regular .env file, which connects to the Vercel Postgres database. Any thoughts on how to do this? I'd like to test develop without fear of changing prod data. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. First of all, I don't think you need to build locally. Your production build generally, unless you're like literally building and drag dropping into an FTP or upload or something like that, that probably is happening in your Vercel pipeline. You said you're using it, right? So your production environmental variables should probably not be on a file on your local system. They should probably be in your Vercel dashboard or in your 1Password or something like that. But I get it. Sometimes you do want to run locally, but with production credentials so you can get live data or for whatever reason. So a couple options here. First, process.env.node_env, that will give you development or production or staging strings. And you can often take that process.env and interpolate that into a .env file. So a lot of people do this. They'll use the .env package, and you'll simply just call the .env config method and pass it process.env.node_env.env, and it will just load the correct package yourself. Second, Node.js now has built-in environmental variable parsing. So what I would probably do in this situation, I think this is what you should do, is you just have two commands, npm run dev and npm run prod or build. You've already said you have those.
Yeah.
And each of those commands will have a flag on them that says --env file. And it will just explicitly point to whether development.env or production.env.
Yeah.
And then the third option here is something is coming to Node very soon. And we cannot tell you what that is, but we got the scoop from somebody who's working on it in Node, and we will tell you. We're having him on the show in a couple of weeks, so stay tuned for that.
Yeah, and I know, unfortunately, this doesn't help you specifically, Mike, but I will rub it in just a little bit that Vite has something like this baked in, and it's really super nice.
Yeah.
So Vite users, I've linked to that docs page where it shows you how to use that. There's basically a host of extensions you can do on your .env files for all of the different modes you could possibly want. So pretty neat. Pretty neat in Vite, I gotta say. All right.
Pretty neat in Vite.
Now is part of the show where we get into sick picks. We pick things that are sick, things that we like, could be anything. In fact, my thing today that I'm picking is a gochujang sauce. I love gochujang.
Oh, big fan.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I've made my own. I have tried just about all of the ones out there, but there's one gochujang that I used to get at a place called Cosmos in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And their gochujang was very sweet in a way that I had sweet and garlicky and spicy, but just spicy enough. And it was a homemade recipe they did there. And unfortunately, I was never able to get mine quite there. I got it kind of close. And the closest I've been able to find is with this mother-in-law's gochujang. Is my favorite gochujang in the whole world. In fact, we were just making some food yesterday that used gochujang, and I used this garlic mother-in-law's gochujang, and this is my favorite one. This same brand makes a bunch of really good ones. They have like a tangy one. I'm posting the link to Amazon here, but I don't typically buy this on Amazon. I get it at the grocery store. But gochujang in general, if you're into like spicy fermented sauce, chili sauce, this stuff rules. I use it on a lot of things. It's different than other types of chili sauces that you might get. And the garlic one for me is really the best. So I just wanted to shout out mother-in-law's gochujang.
Wow, man, that's, talk about Canada, is we have the best Asian grocery stores, at least in Hamilton, Toronto. So there's, I'm always cruising the aisles looking for new stuff like this. So that one looks pretty nifty. I'm gonna, as a condiment enthusiast, I'll keep it rolling here. One of my favorite condiments is called kimchi seasoning from Seoul Sisters. And this is not seasoning for kimchi. It's kind of like the whole fish sauce thing.
Mm.
It's seasoning made from kimchi, and it's just a little shaker bottle, and you throw it on anything. You throw it on eggs, throw it on popcorn, you throw it on a little bit of pizza, anything you want to have a little bit of a spicy fermented kick. Big fan of it.
Yeah. You know, me and kimchi, I have an interesting relationship with kimchi. I don't know why. I don't love it for some reason. I know it feels like something I should love. I love a lot of Korean flavors.
Yeah.
Kimchi never been one of them. I don't know why.
Oh, big fan. I had gotten my first like homemade kimchi a while back. One of my kid's friends is Korean, and she visited her mom, And lots of Koreans have like an entire kimchi refrigerator. And she brought me like the biggest thing of kimchi I have ever seen. And it was homemade. It was so good. It was like extra fermenty. I don't know if the stuff in the stores, they can't ferment as far because it'll explode, but it was, this stuff was amazing. And I think about it all the time. I finished it, unfortunately, but big fan.
Yeah. About half my breakdancing crew is Korean. So we used to always, anytime we'd go to any city, like we'd go to LA for a battle or something and be like, where do you want to go? Oh, let's go to this authentic Korean place. Okay. So I've had a lot of really authentic Korean food, but yeah, never got into kimchi for some reason.
All right. That's it for today. Any shameless plugs we want to plug today? I'll plug my courses, westboss.com/courses. Check it on out if you want to learn a thing or two about JavaScript.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm going to shamelessly plug all of the Syntax socials. We've been on Instagram. We've been on TikTok. We've been on YouTube. And we're posting stuff. So if you're out there and you want more from us, whether that is quick social clips or highlights from these episodes, check us out, Syntax or Syntax.fm on all of the socials. We're there. Look for us. Whichever one you use, we're there. So just search for us and you'll find us.
Yeah, that is doing well. Especially I feel like the TikTok is really getting some good momentum lately. It took a couple of months of regularly posting, but I feel like now we're starting to get like lots of good comments. And if you're listening to this, by the way, can you put baiting comments in the TikTok so people who get angry can reply? That seems to really help.
Oh my gosh. And let me tell you, you can tell you're starting to make it on TikTok because we're starting to get to the point where we're getting a lot of "well, actually" comments. Like,
yeah,
I'm getting people right now that are like, LOL, you should not be sued for having an inaccessible website because, you know, people with disabilities don't matter or something. You know, it's like, it's wild the type of comments we're getting on some of these things. Like we posted one about launching with TypeScript errors, and you wouldn't believe how many of these nerds are like, you should never, never be able to not solve a TypeScript problem. TypeScript is easy to solve. I'm like, brother, you've clearly not been writing TypeScript long enough if you haven't hit something where you just like wanted to do casting or an any at some point. And we've all hit it, you know.
That's a series I would like to do is, not like, you know, they do reading mean comments on the internet.
Oh yeah.
But I would love to do a series of like, well, show me how to fix it. You know, like often on Twitter, people will be like, well, why not this way? And I'm like, all right, like show me how to do it. You know, like I certainly went down the route. Perhaps I didn't see that way, but in a lot of cases I did consider it, but there's like there's something deeper to it that you don't understand, you know? And
right. I think that's that people like to think I'm smarter than you because I don't think there's a problem here without truly understanding what the problem is, you know?
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everybody, tuning in. We'll catch you later.
Peace.
Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.